Welcome, subscribers. We are talking with author, researcher, and lecturer Lloyd Pye, and we have been talking about human origins in our first segment and intervention theory. And we're going to dive into talking more about the star child skull now. This, of course, is a fascinating area, and I remember that I saw a documentary on TV, but an online version of that a few years back, about the star child skull, and I found the material absolutely fascinating, but I haven't kind of kept up with the development since. And you know, for people who are not familiar with this subject at all, I kind of would like to go through this step by step, if possible, how the, you know, the discovery came about of this skull, of course, what it is, what we think it is, the potential age of it, and so forth. There's so much to talk about. But Lloyd, how did the research on the star child skull begin for you?
Well, back in 1990, in late 1998, a couple in El Paso, Texas, in America, named Ray and Melanie Young, were contacted by friends of theirs who said that they had a couple of skulls that they had gotten from a friend of theirs who had died, and that they were, you know, uncomfortable having a couple of human skulls in a cardboard box in their garage, and they wondered if Ray and Melanie might take those skulls off their hands and, you know, like give them a good home kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they assumed Ray, I mean, they assumed Melanie would be okay with it because one of them, one of the skulls, they felt was of a deformed human. Now, it goes back to the, let's go back earlier to the original finding of the skull,
mm-hmm.
and I think it would be better to tell the story that way. The skulls were found back in 1930, in approximately 1930. A woman at that time who was a teenager, she was about 13, 14, 15, in later life she couldn't remember exactly how old she was, and she couldn't remember the exact year, but it was about 1930. She was of Mexican heritage, and her family had come to America and had become American citizens, and finally when she was that age, 13, 14, 15, they were legal and could go back easily and visit the village that they had come from.
Mm-hmm.
And that village was about 100 miles southwest of Chihuahua. So it's in a high desert area, kind of near the Copper Canyon. If anybody knows about that, it's an area that's kind of like the Grand Canyon, but in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So it's high desert, dry, you know, sagebrushy like that.
Mm-hmm.
So she went to visit in this little village, and while there, they told her, don't go in the caves or the mine tunnels around here. We have a lot of those around here, but don't go in because it's dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, you tell a teenager what not to do and also tell them it's dangerous, and what are they going
to
do?
They know what to do then, yeah.
Yeah, go find it. Right, exactly. So she snuck away and went exploring, and in a mine tunnel, she said, she found a human skeleton, a normal human skeleton, lying on its back on the dirt on the floor of the mine tunnel. And then as she got a little closer, she noticed that there was a mound of dirt to the side of this skeleton, and emerging from the side of that mound of dirt, which was clearly a grave, a small grave, was a hand.
Mm.
And that hand, she said, was misshapen. That's all she said, misshapen, and it was wrapped around the upper arm bone of the skeleton lying on the dirt.
Hmm.
What that meant was that the one in the dirt had died, and the human on top had come in, had buried it, had left its hand sticking out of the dirt, so she could lay down, wrap that hand around her own arm, and die.
Hmm.
There's no other way that you'd get that arrangement of the two skeletons.
Mm.
So the young girl, because it was in a mine tunnel, there was no compaction of the dirt of the grave. So it was like it was the day it was dug. So with her hand, she was able to scrape the dirt and all away to reveal another full skeleton there, lying in the mine tunnel that had been buried.
Mm.
and she said that it was smaller than the one on the ground. When the one on the ground was 5 feet tall, so we figure it's noticeably smaller, so we've put it in the 3.5 to 4 foot range.
Mm-hmm.
And she said the body was misshapen.
Mm-hmm.
This is all she said in later life. The hand was misshapen, the body was misshapen. Well, if you go by the head and how misshapen it is, you know, it's a pretty misshapen skeleton.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, she recovers she ends up recovering the two skulls. She tries to recover the whole two skeletons. They're washed away in a flood. She's able to recover only the two skulls after they had both been damaged by being tumbled down a stream in the flood.
Mm-hmm.
The lower face of the star child is completely gone, and the right zygomatic arch of the human being is gone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty clear that they got tumbled down the stream, like she said,
mm-hmm.
and they were damaged. But she did recover also a piece of maxilla that went with the odd skull, or what's come to be called the star child skull.
Mm-hmm.
And the maxilla is the piece of your jaw from the middle of the top of your mouth,
mm-hmm.
middle top, swing it around to the right and up into your nose. That part was recovered as well.
Mm-hmm.
So she smuggled those back in and kept them her whole life, and she shellacked them with varnish when not too long after she had gotten them to preserve them, which was a good thing.
Mm.
And she just kept them as souvenirs. She thought one was normal and one was abnormal.
Mm.
One was some kind of disorder, and she kept them. So she kept them her whole life up into the early 90s when she found out she was going to die from a terminal disease, and then she willed them, gave them to friends of hers who said they would keep them, and those are the people that contacted Ray and Melanie because they were kind of uneasy about having skulls.
Mm.
And Melanie, because Melanie had been a neonatal nurse, which is a nurse dealing with infants and dealing with deformed infants, would be okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when Melanie saw that skull, she knew right away that it wasn't a normal deformity that she knew about.
Mm-hmm.
But because her and her husband, just coincidentally, and here's where the magic starts to happen, just coincidentally, she and her husband were both members of MUFON in El Paso, the Mutual UFO Network.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew about UFOs and aliens, and they knew what a gray was supposed to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And when she looked at that skull, when Ray looked at the skull, they said, man, looks like it would fit in the head of a gray alien perfectly. Because it had the highlights, it had the bulbous head, it had the very small lower face, it had the dent down the upper rear of the head, it had everything a gray is supposed to have. And also, the bone was very, very light, and Melanie could tell it was weighed half as much, and the bone looked to be about half as thin. So she said, I don't think this thing is necessarily human.
Mm.
It's not any kind of deformity I know. We need to get this thing really checked out.
Mm.
And that's where my name came up, because I was doing research into human origins, and I was known. I had just been on the circuit for a year, but I was already fairly well known for what I was doing and for my discussions of skulls that we had in the earlier hour about how pre-human skulls look compared to normal human skulls.
Mm-hmm.
And I was knowledgeable about that. So what they didn't know about me was that I had no real background or interest and had not done any real research into UFOs or aliens. I was a hominoid guy.
Mm-hmm.
I was a human origins guy. I was not a UFO alien guy.
Mm-hmm.
But they contacted me and they said, we have something we'd like you to see, and would you come by next time you're out our way and take a look, which I did, and I was just blown away. I was very impressed. I was convinced, though, initially, that it had to be some kind of human deformity. It just had to be.
Mm.
But I didn't know what. I really didn't know what, so I told them that. I said, it's probably, 90% that this is a deformity of some kind that none of us can call off the top of our head some exotic deformity,
mm.
but I will look into it because there is that 10% that it might not be, and that's an important 10%.
Yeah, indeed.
And so I then began to take it around the country, the U.S., and ultimately into Canada, looking for experts to give me information about it. And I have to tell you, it was difficult to find experts who would give me their opinion, even under, you know, even with anonymity, give me their opinion. Some did, and I chronicled those in the book, but also some of them allowed me to put their name on it as well, and I chronicled those as well. But I started going through a series of discoveries about different aspects of it. We started off with some x-rays that showed that it had no sinus, no frontal sinuses at all, and that's incredibly unusual. I could see for myself that the eye sockets were astonishingly shallow and completely reformed relative to normal human eye sockets, because my father was an optometrist, so I was keenly aware of how eyes were supposed to look, eye sockets, and these were not human-looking eyes as far as I could tell. The x-rays showed that the bone was indeed uniformly half as thin as it should be. And it was clear that it weighed half as much. You could weigh them and see that. So just on the strength of that, we began to believe that, you know, this really could be something.
Yeah.
And then I had an expert go over the eye sockets with me, and he agreed that they were very, very unusual eyes, but what was so amazing about them was that they were perfectly symmetrical. For as odd as they were absolutely equal on both sides to the finest degree of measurement that you could make.
And that
was another thing that Melanie said, that the degree of symmetry of the skull was highly, highly unusual in a deformity. Deformities are just usually lopsided and you know, ugly looking. This, though it looks completely different from a normal human skull, is beautifully put together, a very, very symmetrical, in just a very extremely unusual way. So, also along the way, I talked to a brain specialist, and this guy really turned me around, the brain guy did, because he explained that the star child's brain couldn't be a normal human brain in that head. It was much bigger by 200 cubic centimeters over a normal human skull and by 400 cubic centimeters over a skull that size, which is the size of a small human adult or a child of about 12 years old. So he said, you know, 400 cubic centimeters, like, okay, here are the numbers. A child of about 12 or an adult about 5 feet tall has a skull that contains a brain of about 1,200 cubic centimeters. You and I, if, assuming your average size, and I am, we have brains about 1,400 cubic centimeters. The star child, with a volume that should hold 1,200 cubic centimeters, holds 1,600 cubic centimeters.
Sheesh.
It's like, where's the room? Where do you get that? Where's the extra room come from? He couldn't figure it out, and he never did figure that out. That's just one of those mysteries we don't know yet.
Okay.
But what he did figure out, what he did show me, was that, number one, it's the rear of its head. You and I and your brother and everybody listening to my voice right now, just reach around to the back lower part of your head, where your neck connects to your skull, and feel that knot back there.
Yeah.
You know that little bump back there?
Yeah, sure.
We all have that. That's called the external occipital protuberance, or the inion, short, the inion. If you have that, you're a human being. You're a primate.
Yeah.
Primates have it too. Everybody's got this because it's where your neck connects into your skull, and it's used as a buttress for where a couple of very big neck muscles attach.
So
it's a primate human kind of thing. Star child doesn't have one. In fact, it's got a dent, a fossa, where it should be, where it should have it. It's gone. And and its neck, instead of connecting there where it should, its neck connects down right near where the spine enters into the skull. So its neck, whatever it was about half the volume of our neck. It had a spindly little neck.
Okay.
Now, how do you get that? How do you reduce a normal human neck by about a half? Well, it's a pretty big jump. So that was one issue that he had with it. The other one was that the way the head is shaped and set up, the brain should be pushing straight down. If you look at pictures of it, you see how it slants and back, how flattened it is, but it's not artificially flattened. Its natural convolutions are still in the bone, so it's not artificially flattened that way. It grew that way. Its genes told it to grow that way. But if that's the case, you've got all that extra brain sliding down a very steep slipper slide, you know, a very steep slide, pushing down toward the hole at the bottom of the skull where the spinal cord, the spinal column, rather, enters into the skull. That's called the foramen magnum, that hole, right? You with me?
Yeah, sure.
So, in a human being, where that were to happen, if you were to have that shape, the weight of the brain would push it out through that hole. It would widen that hole, and you would get an aneurysm down there, and basically it would kill the person who had that.
Sheesh, okay.
In infancy. They wouldn't even get out of infancy if they had that, because a child and infant's bones are very soft, right?
Yeah.
Very soft, and they will spread, they will move, they will take shapes that you put pressure on to give them up for the first couple of years. So it wouldn't have made it out of those first 2 years. And yet, the star child lived until it grew teeth and was at least 5 years old, but it could have been 500 years, because we don't know how to judge the way it was. But at least it was 5 years old. So he said, for it to have, and there was no spreading of the foramen magnum at all. So he said, there's no way this is a brain of the same kind of consistency as human brain, or it's just not a brain like we know a brain. So that was very convincing. And he was, of course, a guy who would not let me use his name, because obviously for the volatility of what he was telling me. But he told me his honest opinion, and then he said, I don't want to ever see my name involved in this.
Really?
But nonetheless, when I walked out of that meeting, I had adjusted my ratio to 50-50. I was thinking, you know, this is 50-50 here. But understand, though, the problem I was having with accepting it, that it could be alien or an alien-human hybrid, was that it was the equivalent of that shepherd who found the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I didn't think that could, something like that could happen to me. The odds just were, to me, too long. And yet now I believe that I am the equivalent of that shepherd, you know? That later, as more testing was done, it really looks to me like now it's almost 100% certainty that the star child is a human alien hybrid, and more than that, we're going to be able to prove it beyond a shadow of a doubt in the just the next couple of years. I mean, what really it came down to, the DNA testing. It always, from the beginning, people were saying, whatever you show me in terms of a physical deformity, I am going to say to you that it is possible. It is may not be likely, but it is possible. And as long as it is possible, I don't have to pay attention to it. This is what scientists would say to me. They would say, I would say, but look at this, and look at this, and look at this, and look at this. This is all so unusual. How can you have this many things in one skull, this many things wrong? And they would say, I don't care if you have 1,000 things wrong about this skull. As long as it has to do with its physical capacity, I can say to you it's possible, because in deformity, as we've set up the rules of deformity, anything is possible.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is a human being, as long as all you have to go on is physiological, physiological maladies.
So to them, this is another John Merrick, the Elephant Man, basically.
Right. Exactly. This is just something that they can, as long as we based our argument on physiological differences, we didn't have an argument. Even though, just like the Bigfoot argument, well, they're the tracks. How does something make a 20-inch track that weighs 800 or 900 pounds? It makes that much pressure into the soil, and it's got, you can see dermal ridges on it. How could that possibly not be made by a living thing? Well, it just wouldn't. Well, boy, it just wouldn't. That's all I can tell you. It just wouldn't. You know, it's just stupid beyond imagining, but that is how they can hide behind that.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
But they said, now, DNA, on the other hand, show me some DNA, and I've got to pay attention to it. Because DNA is their tool. It's their weapon. It's their thing. And it can't be manipulated. It can't be changed. There's so much of it. If it lines up a certain way, it is one thing. And if it lines up a certain way, it's another thing. So show me the DNA, they said. Everybody said. So we finally arranged to have DNA testing done in 2003. In the summer of 2003. And what we found was that first of all, the skulls are well preserved. You have to understand that. It's important. The skulls are well preserved. They were in a mine tunnel. Oh, and I should say that they were carbon 14 dated at 900 years ago, plus or minus 40 years. Now,
900 years. Wow.
Excuse,
yeah, 900 excuse years. Me? Wow. That's a long time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
That means it's ancient DNA, 900 years ago, plus or minus 40 years. Both skulls were done at different times in different labs and came up with the same exact result, which is very unusual. So it's time to do the DNA. And we know that we have two well-preserved 900-year-old skulls to go after. So we go to the lab to begin to cut the pieces out of the skulls that we're going to use to do the test. Well, the human cuts like human normally cuts. The star child proves to be much harder to cut. And the geneticists were very impressed by how hard it was to cut because it was so much thinner. It looked like it would be just, whoop, like cutting an eggshell. But in fact, very difficult, much more difficult than cutting normal human bone. So right away, we have a mystery. Then they take the normal human bone and they put it in what's called EDTA. Now, EDTA is a dissolving solvent used to dissolve bone and human bone. And what they do is they put it in a piece of it in a test tube, and they put the EDTA on it, and they put it in a rocker. And in about a week of rocking on the rocker, the bone is fully dissolved where you can then begin to extract its DNA.
I see.
The human bone dissolved in a week. The star child bone didn't dissolve at all. Not in a week, not in 2 weeks, not in a month.
Really?
Finally, they had to put a very powerful detergent on it called Tween 20, and that dissolved it overnight. I mean, just because it's such a powerful detergent. And so then they were able to extract the star child's DNA. So the human, when they extracted its DNA, you need to understand there are two kinds of DNA. There is mitochondrial DNA, which is little chips of DNA, about 16,000 base pairs long, and they float outside the nucleus.
Okay.
Inside the nucleus is the nuclear DNA, and that is the whole genome of your mother and your father, your whole entire genomic package is sitting there in the nucleus of all of your cells. And floating outside is the mitochondrial chips, the mitochondrial DNA that comes only from your mother. From your mother.
Keep
that in mind. So, for the human found with the star child, the mitochondrial DNA was easy to recover, and it showed that its mother, the mother of the person found with the star child, its mother was from a type of Mesoamerican called haplogroup A. It's a haplogroup, and it's A. There are five types, A, B, C, D, and X.
Okay.
So it's Haplogroup A, very common, nothing unusual about it. Also, the human's nuclear DNA was easily recovered, and it proved to be a female.
Mm-hmm.
So she was a female.
Mm-hmm.
We had always assumed that it was the mother of the star child.
Yeah.
We had always assumed it was the mother because clearly she buried it, and then she laid down with it and died and killed herself.
Mm-hmm.
So we figured nothing but a mother would do that. You right?
Yeah, sure.
So when the star child's mitochondrial DNA was recovered, it too was recovered very easily. And it said that its mother was from haplogroup C, not haplogroup A,
okay.
Haplogroup C. So that told us right away that the two of them were not genetically related.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what, for whatever reason, she was not genetically related to the star child.
Mm.
However, when it came time to do the star child's nuclear DNA, now we already know that its nuclear DNA is there because there's very little degradation because it was, you know, buried in a mine tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
There's no degradation to speak of in the human, so there should be no degradation to speak of in the star child. And yet, its nuclear DNA is not recoverable by human-only primers in six full attempts. In
okay.
six full attempts, no recovery whatsoever. Now, what did that tell us in 203? What did we know for a fact, for sure, in 203? That the star child's mother is human and the father is not.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the father was human, then the primers would have pulled it up and we would have been done with the star child in 203.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't. So we knew that the father wasn't human, but as the geneticist said, all we can say is that we can't recover the nuclear DNA. We can't say this means that the father is an alien.
Mm-hmm.
All we can say is that we can't recover the nuclear DNA because there is some problem with
mm-hmm.
the father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we can't say, that doesn't mean he's an alien. What we need to be able to say specifically is how far his DNA, or the star child's DNA, lies away from the human norm.
Hmm.
And we can't do that given the primer situation that we have now.
Hmm.
But they held out some hope in 203 to me. They said, at the pace with which our field is moving forward, you can expect a breakthrough within 3 to 5 years that should allow you to recover the, you know, either much more of the star child's DNA or all of it.
Mm-hmm.
But you just have to be patient.
Mm.
So I said, well, what do I do in the meantime? And they said, well, you can get the quality of the bone, the biochemistry of the bone checked, because it's way too hard for it to be normal human bone.
Mm.
Get it checked. So in 204, I went to London to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, when we got it, when we took the bone and looked at it under a scanning electron microscope, lo and behold, we found that woven through the matrix of the bone is a kind of fiber. There's just no other way to say it. But it's different kinds of fibers. And if you go on the website, if you go on the website, www.starchildproject.com, or get the book, The Star Child, you know, the Star Child Skull book, in those photos you will see very clearly the fibers, samples of those fibers that were taken by the photographs through the scanning electron microscope. An incredible discovery, to which science just shrugged again. Well, it's physiological, so we don't know how it happened, but it's physiological, so anything can happen. Well, all right. So then later in that year in London, we found that in the cancellous holes, which are the holes where marrow normally is, but when you die, they are cleaned out spick and span by bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So there should have been absolutely nothing in its cancellous holes. And yet we found that there's reddish residue speckled all through the cancellous holes of the star child bone.
Oh, really?
No idea what that is either.
Hmm.
Strange. So, after 204 and 205, I came back here with really nothing more to do because, again, nothing physiological matters to science. All that matters to science is the DNA.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I was just going to have to wait until this breakthrough, this assumed breakthrough would occur.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I started writing the book and was just sort of waiting and going to see what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Well, miracle of miracles, just as I was finishing the book, actually had already finished it, first draft of it.
Mm-hmm.
The breakthrough occurred late last year. It was announced by 454 Life Sciences. This is the company, what it's called, 454 Life Sciences of,
mm-hmm.
of Branford, Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
that they had invented a way to recover every single base pair in any genome at all.
Really?
In other words, they just recover base pairs, so they can recover the base pairs, all the base pairs, of anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, that was great news in the world of science,
yeah.
because it allowed them to recover one of the holy grails of science, which is Neanderthal nuclear DNA. They're going to be able to recover, they think, the genome of a Neanderthal.
Yeah, that's right.
They can lay it down and compare it point by point, gene by gene,
mm-hmm.
to a human being and see, and a chimp for that matter, mind you, and a gorilla, and
mm-hmm.
anything else they want to compare it to, and see how far it lies away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is important because you want to be able to say, where does Neanderthal lie relative to humans and chimps? Is it closer to chimps? Is it closer to humans? If
mm-hmm.
it's close to humans, how close?
Mm-hmm.
Are they you know, kissing cousins, or are we that we not related to them at all?
Mm.
This is an important thing to know.
Indeed.
But what's missed in all of that is the same identical test can be applied to the star child bone.
Mm.
And we can find the same thing about the star child's father that we can determine about the Neanderthal and its mother and its father.
Mm-hmm.
Where do they lie? Where does the star child lie relative to a human being,
mm.
and how far away? Well, we know that it's going to be significantly away from the norm.
Mm.
Why? Because so much about its physiology is different. The same thing that science says we can ignore as long as it's just physiology cannot be ignored when it comes to DNA, mm. because every one of those physiological differences, and there are 24 major physiological differences in the between the star child and a normal human being.
Hmm.
Every one of those major, and not this is not counting the many minors, but every one of the majors and all the minors
mm-hmm.
are different because a gene or a gene combination in the star child told it to grow that way.
Hmm.
And for every one of those differences that created a physiological difference, you're going to have a difference in the DNA profile.
Mm-hmm.
So every one of them is going to move the star child further and further away from normal.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, it just comes down to what is the percentage of difference going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Is it going to be half of 1%, 1/10 of 1%, fully 1%, 2%, 3%? If it's 3%, understand, it's as different as a chimp.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It's as different as a chimp if it's 3%.
Mm-hmm.
It could be 10%. It could be 15%. We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
All we know is that it's going to be different in another direction from chimp. You see what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
It isn't going to be moving toward chimp.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be on a tangent of some kind. We don't know where it's going to go, but it's going to establish a whole new line away from the human norm.
Yeah,
that is going to make it alien. And
yeah,
that is going to prove that the star child skull is a human alien hybrid. So it's really exciting and it's very big news. It's some of the biggest news in the world right now that almost nobody knows about. Relatively speaking, almost nobody knows about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet it is incredibly important.
And as far as we know, this is also the only one of its kind, or do you know if there's more?
Only one of its kind, right. Now, there is another group of very unusual skulls that I think could very easily prove out to be alien as well, and that's the coneheads down in Peru. Peru has hundreds of conehead skulls socked away in their museums, and you can see these on the internet as well. They have these huge, big heads sticking off the rear of a normal human-looking-like face, but they have a brain. All of them have brains between 2,800 and 3,000 cubic centimeters, so their brains are fully twice the size of our brain.
Sheesh, wow.
And I think these people were not human beings like we are.
Yeah.
And I think their DNA needs to be analyzed every bit as much as the Star Child, and I think that it will.
Yeah.
Once the Star Child's done and proven to be what it is, I think that the Coneheads will be.
Mm.
So far as I know, at this point, they have not been analyzed.
So, I mean, this is fascinating. I mean, this is a young child then that has died. Is there any way possible to see why the child died?
No, there is no way to know. There is no way to know. It could have been disease. It could have been a wound. It could have been a pathogen of any kind. There is no way to know.
There's not like, signs of violence or stuff like that they discover sometimes, in graves and stuff like that the skull
has. Right, there are no signs of violence on the skull.
Okay. Wow, this is fascinating. And you said also, you talked about the reddish residue that was found inside the Star Child bone. I also saw on the website about these fibers that were found, and I don't know if you made the connection or what the connection were here, but you've done a little bit of research, I guess, even into Morgellons and a possible connection, or that there is something going on there.
We have one of the first things people say is, well, what about Morgellons?
Mm-hmm.
We call it Morgellons. I don't know if you call it Morgellons, but we call it Morgellons here.
Mm-hmm.
Morgellons it produces kinds of fibers that are basically, apparently, skin-oriented. They come up through the skin. They are involved in the skin. And they are visible with the naked eye. Whereas the fibers of the Star Child are microscopic in size. I mean, absolutely microscopic. And they are buried in the bone itself, in the matrix of the bone. So, for whatever Morgellons might be, they seem to be apples and oranges relative to the fibers in the Star Child. I do not see any kind of connection at this point.
Yeah. So, in your research into the Star Child skull, is this an evidence for a genetic manipulation, or do you think that this is a couple, a non-human father then and a human mother that had a child together, about 900 years ago, something like that, in the Mexican
area? I personally believe that it would almost have to be done genetically in a lab. I do not think you can take two beings that are so different physiologically. And again, I think that the Star Child is probably the hybrid offspring of a human mother and a gray alien father.
Really?
But
wow.
With that said, understand some of the mechanics of manipulation to create this.
Mm-hmm.
When you create a hybrid, you're not doing a 50-50 deal. You're not necessarily even a horse and a donkey producing a mule.
Mm-hmm.
The mule looks much more like a horse than it does like a donkey.
Mm-hmm.
See what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
So you don't get a 50-50 split necessarily, even in a natural hybridization. It's 60-40 or it's 70-30 or whatever. But it isn't going to be 50-50. But if you do it in a lab, you are now capable of producing a 90-10 or a 95-5 if you want. All you really have to do, really, is take the, in the case of a human and say a gray, if you're going to let the, it's going to have to be gestated in the human because the egg is big. You know, the egg is so much bigger than the sperm. The egg is easier to manipulate.
Mm-hmm.
So what you can do is you can take out all the autosomes in the human egg. There will be, for a human, 23. There are 23 chromosomes. So you take out the 22 autosomes, and you leave the one sex chromosome, which would be, you know, for a female, an X.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, starting with that, and also, but you have to leave all the other stuff in there as well. You can only remove the autosomes because the egg has the whole package to create the thing. The egg is the template.
Mm-hmm.
Females are the template of our species.
Mm-hmm.
Males are created as an alternative to that template.
Mm-hmm.
By the effects of the Y chromosome. So if you took out all of the 22 autosomes of the human and replaced that with a gray alien package, then you'd have the influence of the human mother. You'd have the X chromosome in there,
mm-hmm.
and you'd have her package producing. But you could, in all other ways, it's a gray alien. So I think it's possible that something on that order occurred and that the woman found with the star child was a surrogate mother. In other words, the egg had come from another female.
Mm.
They had mixed that together with their own sperm of the gray or whatever, and then the egg had been implanted into her such that she could bring it to term. Now, that's just speculation on my part.
Mm-hmm.
I can't prove it.
Sure.
But I think that that's quite possible.
Mm-hmm.
So in any event, I do think that the star child is not the result of natural sexual union. I just can't imagine that. It could be true, but I think it's much more likely, given that I think there is a clear record of genetic manipulation of life species on Earth anyway, going back thousands of years, as we talked about earlier with the Anunnaki creating human beings, if we're already a genetically engineered and genetically created species, I see no problem at all in creating yet another kind of species using our part of our genetic package.
Mm.
And I think the star child would be an example of that, and I think that because you have so many examples of women in the world claiming that they are taken on board craft, that they are made pregnant with hybrids, and that at the fourth month of gestation, those hybrids are removed and they have every sign of a miscarriage but no fetus.
Yeah.
I think in as much as you have that, enough of, you know, as much of that as you do out there, there is very likely something to it.
Yeah, I mean, this about, you know, creating a hybrid race between the humans and the grays, this has been, you know, a hot topic for you know, quite a long time now. But but thinking about...
And I just think that somehow the star child got away from them, because they seem to manage that program pretty well, and somehow, and maybe by virtue of being in a mine tunnel, hidden away, they got away, the woman and the star child.
Yeah.
Because... that, you know, there's just no sign of anything else being left behind in this program up to now that I'm aware of.
Yeah. And it's kind of, you know, very interesting to realize that this might have been going on for 900 years. Wow.
Well, not just 900 years, thousands of years. I mean, it could who knows?
That's right, yeah.
If we've been here for 200,000 years, it could have been going on. We could have populated, you know, one of the things keep in mind about genetic hybrids like this is that frequently they are sterile.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
like a mule,
mm-hmm.
is sterile. A horse and a donkey makes a mule, but the mule is sterile, so you can't have a breed of mules where mules make more mules.
You have to
use a horse and a donkey every time to create a mule.
Ah, I didn't know that.
It could well be that the star child and anything like it is sterile, so that you have to keep making them as you need them. Between, you know, with humans and starch, and excuse me, and grays, to make the star-child hybrid.
Ah.
But they're sterile, so you just have to keep making them. And that's what I suspect. It's just an ongoing program because they're sterile, and whatever planet they're on, whatever use, whoever has for them, whatever planet is being populated, they are not yet fecund so that they can create themselves on their own.
Yeah, wow, isn't that interesting? Because you hear, you hear this about that there's a hybridization program going on, that they haven't kind of succeeded with it or something like that. But this is a very good explanation for that, then, that they have to continue coming back here, you know, to harvest the fetus, as it were, you know?
Yep.
Wow. Whew, fascinating. And, I mean, we might be able even to, if this company, 454 Life Sciences, are... you know, I guess you're waiting then, you know, for the final results, the percentages of how much the DNA will differ.
Well, no, you have to understand what the mechanics of that situation is.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked to some people that are involved with 454, and this is it. Because the technology is brand new last year, they don't have many machines made yet that can do the work.
Oh, okay.
And all of the machines that are being produced are going into the Neanderthal Project.
Yeah, of course.
Because science wants the Neanderthal Project answered.
Mm.
So they're throwing all their money and all behind it. Now, as of right now, it's about a $500,000, $500,000 project. And it's going to take 2 years.
Mm.
Because you've got, you know, 3 billion base pairs to recover.
Mm.
So, but as the machines are being created, they're being created.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't only be used for the Neanderthal. Once the Neanderthal is over,
mm-hmm.
those machines are going to be sitting there able to do other things.
Open up for other...
So, the Neanderthal is supposed to finish sometime late next year, 2008.
Mm-hmm. Really?
They're supposed to have the whole genome collected sometime around the end of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Well, once that's done, then we, with the Star Child, can get in line to be one of the next projects that are handled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Again, understanding that 3 billion base pairs, X set of machines to do the work, is going to take a certain amount of time. But it isn't going to take 2 years.
Hmm.
They suspect it'll be less than a year.
Mm.
By, say, 2009, they'll have it down under a year to do a whole genome.
Hmm.
And they think that the price will drop to under $100,000.
Hmm.
That's, you know, the estimate now. It could go under $50,000. We don't know.
Yeah.
It's just a market thing.
Hmm.
But when the price is within range, within reach, and I think $50,000 might be within range for our community, where we put out the word and say, look, we need $50,000 to get the Star Child's DNA tested, everybody chip in, and let's get it done. So if we can get it started in 2009, according to my geneticist, we'll have an answer sometime in 2010.
Mm. Wow.
You see?
Yeah.
So that's the scenario right now. Now, let me say this. If we were to come across, if somebody who's very well healed, who has a lot of money, hears about the Star Child or reads the book or whatever and just says, I want an answer to this and I don't care as soon as possible and I don't care what it costs, I'll put up the money, then, you know, Steven Spielberg or George Lucas or Dan Aykroyd or, you know, any of those guys who were involved in UFO alien stuff, Hollywood, one of them might say, all right, let's just get it underway right now. Then we could start tomorrow.
That's right.
We could, as soon as we could get space on a machine, we could do it.
That's right.
But for the most part, the machines are going to be tied up doing the Neanderthal till the Neanderthal is over.
Yeah.
See what I mean?
Yeah. Do you have like a donations area on your website so people that
no,
want to
No, we're not asking for donations now because we're not ready.
Okay.
So it's
yeah.
It's unfair to ask for money when you don't really have a purpose for it yet. I mean, we know when we have a price, we'll do one of those little thermometer things where people can track where we are, with the collection.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll will do that when the time comes, but the time is just not here yet.
Yeah.
But everybody can rest assured that we're on top of it, that we know what we need to do, that the technology is out there to allow us to do it. It's just a matter of being patient again until the opportunity presents itself, and then we'll do our best to seize it.
Excellent. Is this skull in your possession now? Do you own
no,
it, as
no.
it were?
No, skull, the original, stays with its owners, Ray and Melanie, in El Paso, and they keep it, well protected.
Okay.
It's really one of the most valuable things in the world. It's like King Tut's mask anything you can, the Mona Lisa, you know what I mean? It's just very valuable.
Definitely.
So they take care of it. However, I will say this was interesting. At the first week in July, they took it out for the first time since October of 99, and they put it on display at the big celebration that we had in Roswell, New Mexico, of the 60-year anniversary of the crash of the UFO near Roswell.
Yeah.
And we made a very beautiful display case for the two skulls, and we put it in the in a special room at the UFO Museum there in Roswell, and over 3,000 people were able to come through and see it with their own eyes for the first time since 1999. So that was pretty exciting.
Wow, wonderful.
Yeah.
Looking at the photographs of the skull, maybe you can explain this. It seems like there is kind of two ends going off towards both of the eyes when I'm looking at the photographs. Like if you imagine the end of the nose. Like there's two almost bones sticking up towards the eyes. Is that, what is
those two bones that are sort of down a little bit that just stick off by themselves? They look about the end of a fingertip, kind of.
Yeah?
Yeah. Those bones are called the pterygoid plates, and everybody has them. The star childs are about half normal size, though.
Mm-hmm.
But what they do is they are just simply buttress bones that your upper jaw and upper face rests against. And so what they're there for is if you were to get hit in the face really hard and you didn't have those buttress bones there, your upper jaw could jam back and crush the inner part, the inside of your skull, and it would kill you. It could kill you very easily.
Mm-hmm.
So those two bones allow you to get hit in the front of the face, and your teeth will break out before the bone will slide back in and crush your brain, crush your midbrain.
Okay, I see. Okay, that's good.
If you look at the human, you'll see its pterygoid plates as well.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm looking at the comparative picture there. Yeah,
you do a sideways view of them, and you can see them very clearly.
Okay, yeah, excellent. So, I mean, what's up next here for you, Lloyd? I mean, you're involved in a lot of different areas, but where are you going
now? Well, we're just trying to get the book out as widely as we can, put it in the hands of people, get the message out that we have this amazing thing and that people, should make themselves and their friends aware of it. And anybody that is interested in UFOs and aliens and has friends that scoff at it and say, oh, it's ridiculous, you can say, here, read this book. This book will show you. And then, I go around and I make presentations, like I'm going to be in San Jose, California at the big UFO Expo at the end of this month. And sometimes, I go to foreign countries as well when people put on affairs there, when they have conferences or expos or whatever.
Sure.
I've been to Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
as close as I've been to Sweden. But Amsterdam and Germany and England, of course.
Yeah.
And Australia. So it just depends. I go where people are interested and want to bring me. And so my wife and I will, that's how we do when we travel around, and we show it to anybody that's interested. So that's really what we're doing until we, have the breakthrough that allows us to initiate the testing process.
Yeah.
And, of course, once we have that, then there will be a lot more interest in it. And maybe even at that point, the mainstream media will start taking, paying attention to it.
That's right, exactly. And, I would love to, to keep, you know, I'm going to keep an eye on this story, as it were, and if there are any developments in any way, I would love to, you know, have you back soon on the show and do something more
about
it.
Well, if there are any developments, you know, that would be great, but I don't anticipate any developments probably through next year, because they're just, it's not our time yet. We have to wait till the price gets within range.
That's
the
right.
The only alternative, the only breakthrough would be, again, as I said, if someone with a lot of money is willing to put that money up and say, you know, I want this underway as soon as possible, and I'm willing to pay for it.
That's right.
In which case, then we'll move in that direction.
And that's why it's important also to help, as you say, to spread the word, because you never know where help might come from, right?
Exactly. It's the ripple effect.
Yeah.
You just never know when you are the person who says the right thing to the right person in the right way, and it kicks it off in a whole new direction. Exactly that.
That's right. Yeah, again, Lloyd, I want to thank you, you know, so much for a wonderful program. This has been a pleasure to have you on, and fascinating material talking about this. But before we round things off again, in case we have a few people only listening to this second part, tell people how they can get your two books that you have out there.
Okay, well, the first book, Everything You Know Is Wrong, which deals with my human origins and intervention theory work, is right now only available as a used book on Amazon. We're not selling new copies of that, and haven't been for a couple of months, because I'm redrafting it, and the new copy, the updated version, won't be available until October. I'm sorry to say, but that's just the way it's working out.
Hmm.
Now, the new book about the Star Child, The Star Child Skull, and its subtitle is Genetic Enigma or Human Alien Hybrid, but The Star Child Skull is available now, and it's available as a hardback through Belllap Books, www.bell.lap, L-A-P, like you run a lap around a track, and books, B-O-O-K-S. So it's belllapbooks.com, and that is a hardback that I'll sign and inscribe for you in any way you like, but it's expensive. You know, it's a hardback. It's got 300 pages, 40 color slides, but it's a very good book. The paperback, which has only black and white photos, and is, of course, significantly cheaper and doesn't require shipping across the ocean unless you want it signed. It will be available soon, probably next week.
Mm-hmm.
Next week, there, just go to your local bookstore, go to your Amazon, your local Amazon, and it'll be printed in London, so you'll be able to get it at a reasonable price. So that's starting next week. So that's the way you do it. And the website itself, again, is www.starchildproject.com, relative to the Star Child, starchildproject.com. And my personal website is www.lloydpie.com. My name is spelled LLOYDPYE, lloydpie.com.
Excellent. And do check that out. Again, there's tons of excellent and interesting, intriguing information up on those websites for you to look at, articles and photos and slideshows and audio presentations and much, much more. So again, thank you so much, Lloyd, for coming on. As I said, this has been a pleasure, and I'm looking forward to doing it again soon.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having me, and I do look forward to coming back in some other time.